And you know, I think it was because of her using you and Rosenbaum using I that I started using we.
Royal we.
Actually, oh, great.
Yeah, well, we in the sense of, because what we does, I think, is then it involves you in the collective.
Right.
Essentially.
I use you. I don't. So, I never.
You want us all to be communist, Keith.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Exactly.
I think we is troublesome too, just because. Yeah, I don't. Again, it gets back to my worry about arrogation. Like, I don't.
I'm not going to be presumptuous enough to speak for anybody.
Well, there's no right way to do this. I mean, that's just.
I mean, this is everything I like too. This is just, we're talking about words and how words.
Why you should use them.
That's something that Manny Farber taught me when you told me to go get that book was, you just got to be precise. You know, you got to think that every word matters, and you just got to make sure that even how you're going to put together one sentence will speak to every other sentence.
If I talk
about the thread as my metaphor for the essay, I'm going to need to bring up that metaphor another paragraph and then again another paragraph, and I'm just going to have to keep weaving that, of course.
I think also these terms, I, we, and you, I think they all exist, and I think when I was saying to Kevin, you know, rising to the challenge of each movie, I think it's like rising to the challenge of each review too, which means, you know, what construction is right for this piece, and I sort of believe in some ways that the movie tells you how to write about it, and you have to be kind of open to that, you know, kind of
that's
flow or whatever.
Definitely one of my criteria is that you have to pay attention to the logic an object gives you. You can never look to seek to prove anything with an object, and you can never seek to denigrate something because it fails to live up to something. I mean, sometimes things do fail, and that I can't just ignore that. But
I do feel like the object is for me has become the most important thing. There's a lot of criticism I read now that seems to take the reaction to something as paramount over the object itself.
It's like the reaction itself is the end. In some way, that's an outcome to be expected of critic. You know,
when you trade with critics,
I mean,
but that seems to be like the, for whatever reason, the entry point for a good deal of criticism in some way, and it's just not something that increasingly, I don't respond to it.
I mean, now we're getting to a point. If you go to the blogosphere, you know, half the stuff written online is about other people's pieces.
That's always been the case, though. I mean, if you look at early Pauline Kael and early, all they're doing is bitching at each other.
She was taking down Stanley Kaufman.
It's not just her. They all, Sarah.
The whole Circles and Squares essay and everything. You know, back and forth. I kind of find that, you know, unproductive. I mean,
it is basically unproductive, I think.
I mean, I think if you're going to take someone down, you need to have all your shit together in, like, such a strong way, and you need such a strong case to do it, and you need to be, like, you know, I think one of Dan's favorite takedown essays was Sontag of Riefenstahl. And she, you know, I mean, rightfully deserved it, and the woman
was a Nazi. She was Hitler's mistress.
But Sontag went in there and, you know, basically dive bombed the shit out of her. And then I don't think really there's...
And Sontag almost never wrote negative essays of anything. All essays she wrote were appreciations of things that she admired.
She made
an exception in this particular case because she was appalled in the mid-70s that Leni Riefenstahl was getting all this sort of, let's just forget it. That's about look at these new photographs. And she said no. And she took the evidence and
picks her apart like I said, dive bombs the shit out of her, and then she doesn't need to say anything after that. It's just kind of like, here's my case, boom, you know.
Last word, and
there it is. It's like sitting there in the midst of all this reevaluation.
Yeah, that's such a good feeling when you feel like you've really nailed something in a piece that you've written.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean, and
no, that's a perfect example because I mean, Leni Riefenstahl. I mean, she made films for Hitler. You know, it's like, it isn't like taking to task some, you know, commercial movie that's very bad for our morals or very bad for our artistic appetite or aesthetics.
Yeah, which I don't think you can really judge, per se.
I mean, that's one thing. Like, that's a very extreme case. So, you know.
So it's kind of like an extreme, it only in extreme cases require extreme reactions. But I think the things that a lot of people treat as extreme are very minor in a lot of cases. Yeah. But if it stirs them up enough, it's kind of like they feel like, oh shit, it's the end of civilization. And there's a lot of end of civilization talk about a lot of different things now. It's just kind of like, I think, look, we're still here, and as long as we're alive, we better write about where we are, as opposed to, like, you know...
Oh, yeah, like...
As opposed to, like, holding signs and saying the end is nigh. You know, it's like...
Yeah, we all know Guillermo del Toro doesn't really know how to shoot an action sequence, so you don't really need to, like, talk about how dumb Hellboy 2 is.
Well, not everybody knows, but Dan probably won't see Guillermo del Toro's films anytime soon, which is fine. Because Hellboy sucks. But anyway, we need to get into that.
Anyways, that was just a tangent joke.
Yes.
I want to touch on the thing about reconsidering films that you've seen, and you know, the question that you ask yourself is: this film really that good? And less that's history tough. Prove you wrong in the future.
Yes.
And I'm kind of about to embark on this project. I just don't know if I have enough time to do it. But a year from now, we're all going to be fussing over our, well, maybe not Keith, but everybody else will be fussing over their 10 best films of the decade and stuff, so on, so on, so forth.
Oh, that's right.
And
Holland Drive is all 10.
Well, what I'm going to do, what I want to do, is revisit some of the films that I, you know, are tops on my list for each year, and just
see if they hold up.
See if they hold up, and see if I was proven wrong, or in some cases, watch films that I wasn't that blown away by, like Inland Empire, and see if I missed the boat.
So what are some of the films that you're going
to watch? Well, I'm actually going to Taiwan to a cousin's wedding, so I'm going to bring E.E. with me. That might add some significance to it.
You didn't care for that?
Oh, I love it, actually. I just wonder if I'll,
you'll still...
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
I can say that I just watched the Joe Dante Looney Tunes movie yesterday with Ryland, and that held up beautifully. Mm. I think being so close to Crystal Skull, I'd honestly consider that right now as being potential best of for me. But, you know, I think that would be something...
I think that's why whenever they do a decade list, it always is something made in the zero or the one or the 2 year, because they've had time to think about it.
So much time to think about it.
Yeah, like they almost never do they put something that was made in, 1997 or 1988.
They usually pick the wrong one. Because I think, I think a lot of people probably would have put Being John Malkovich as best of the 90s if they had more time to think about it. But I think from today's perspective, I don't think it would make the cut.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a film that just... It had so
at
much
time, yeah.
It had so much kind of zeitgeist behind it, and now
and the Blair Witch Project. Too,
oh my God, yeah,
like that.
And, yeah,
and Safe.
Right.
Well, Safe. Safe. I think is still great.
Safe could. Yeah. Safe. I think holds its own.
Safe is definitely.
I certainly like Safe more than his subsequent films.
Now, what about this decade?
Yeah, good question.
It's
the New World.
Well, yes.
Now, I was listening to you. I was reading your conversation, the transcripted part, and.
Yeah.
Yeah, it made me want to watch the 3-hour cut. I've already, I liked the first cut enough, and I saw the 2.5-hour cut, and I couldn't even finish it. And so maybe the 3-hour cut, I don't know. Now, and that brings up a whole other ball of wax, which is, versions of a film.
Right.
Like how do you get your head around, three or four or five different versions of a film and say which one works for you, and does it work enough? Or
I think you have to acknowledge each version of the film as... Part of the experience, whether or not you...
Generally, you like one of them best.
Generally, you do, but I think critically, you have to acknowledge that there are, varying versions in existence. And I think the creator has a responsibility to allow the different versions that have been available to be widely available together.
Yeah.
For example...
Are we talking about here? Are we talking about, how many versions of what are we talking about?
Well, there's three versions of the New World, for example, but there's all different kinds of versions going.
That's a lot.
There's all different kind of versions of movies going back to the beginning of time. I mean,
Bruce Conner's a lot of them. He just has different versions floating around because he's edited different versions of them. And
there's two
report. That's the one I just saw. Apparently there's, untold 20 versions just floating around.
There's two cuts of Miami Vice. I only like the theatrical cut of that.
Yeah, same here.
Lang's films have seen all different kinds of versions. I think a lot of them producer cut and everything. And, you sort of have to try to sort that. There's what Ray Carney did with The Shadows the Cassavetes' first film, finding the original cut that Jonas Mekas praised mm-hmm. and said was better than the subsequent version, which was more widely available. And then Carney actually wrote a book where he detailed each, like minute by minute or second by second each.
I kind of wonder if shot, all that's sort of a shell game that these guys play with each other just to, you know, say, oh, I know better than you do.
Yeah, well, it's just this possessorship. A lot of that.
Well, I mean, these are all very particular. I mean, I don't think it's. I think it's really there's more of a modern thing because of the. I think a lot of the time there aren't so many famous movies that there's more than one version mm-hmm. of it.
Well, but then there's like Lost, Magnificent Ambersons.
Right.
There's
right.
the Lost.
Or there's they ruined it by cutting it, and what did they cut? Yeah.
With the advent of DVD, it allowed for extended cuts. So therefore, if you had to cut things to get an R rating in the theater, now you can add things onto the DVD, to make it raunchier. So you have the unrated cut and stuff. Now, as an example, like the recent X-Files movie, I Want to Believe, I prefer the theatrical cut because it's more implicative. And because in the extended cut that they have on DVD, the gore is more up front and like on screen longer. Mm. And that actually detracts from it, I find. I find that when it was cut to the bone, it was actually like these things would come at you almost in subliminal flashes, and it made it all the freakier. Or like there's the two versions of The Exorcist. And I prefer the earlier version that Friedkin cut originally because,
Well, yeah, that's a different thing as somebody going back after years and adding things later. Yeah.
Right.
That's almost never a good idea.
I mean, and then there's even in Mishima, the Schrader film, he actually went in and added a scene with Chishiryu. for like a 20-second little addition to the Temple of the Golden Pavilion sequence, and in the Runaway,
does it work?
Yes. I mean, I've seen
it nice.
I've seen the deleted scene, and I mean, it's just Chishiryu playing Go and talking to his student for like a few seconds. But it's great to have Chishiryu in the film. I mean, it makes sense that he'd be there, in some way, shape, or form.
Wait, now, this had already been shot?
It had already been shot in the 80s, and it had been taken out, and then Schrader just added it back into the new cut. And it's actually on the Criterion DVD and was in the one that, at Film Forum. But also, he went into the Runaway Horses section, and he actually digitally colored a sky so that in one shot it matched the rising sun of the other. So he actually, changed the color of a specific scene in order to more match what he had hoped for, because it always annoyed him, he said, since 85, that he couldn't get it with that technology. And it actually doesn't detract from it. I mean, I don't think you would notice it, even if...
It's not like the Death Star with a bigger explosion.
It's a very small...
I mean, the thing is, I have to wonder how much of that just amounts to marketing, It's like you got a new version with new features.
Mishima is not something that anyone ever expected to make money, so I really don't think it was a marketing thing. And Schrader is such an obsessive that it's kind of like...
With some of these movies.
Of course, like with the Superbad extra extended feature.
Oh my! Yeah, see that makes a joke of the whole thing. I mean, it's just like people. It's really for the fanboys who just want the experience.
Who want
to
more
add,
penis jokes?
Blast
or
into infinity, and I don't think it adds anything to the artistic value of the work.
Right, but it's sort of like you have to. I think you had to account for some of these things in some ways, and it's.
It's
difficult. I mean, but nobody has said it would be easy.
I think it's
to do,
the curse of the DVD era, really.
But there are precedences for this,
it sounded great at the time back in the early 90s when we talked about director's commentaries and that sort of thing.
It's grown out of control. But the thing is, you have to take each case as it comes. Even though we might now say a good majority of things or do not benefit from being extended or not, I think that's just, the ends of this particular thing, It's good in certain cases, but then a lot of people say, ooh, what a great idea, and they run with it, and they market it, and they make it into, a homogenized thing. And I think it's whether or not, I like to believe that the crap and the good stuff balances out in some way, but I think that just the human condition is that the crap always makes a deeper impression. Mm. I think that's just the way of things. So,
well, I want to bring this back to critical revisions, since we're talking about value.
Indeed.
Critical values. I mean, you asked me, Dan,
so
about
some of the films.
AI, I think, is a film that I need to revisit because I watched, when I watched it, I had a reaction very much sort of on the defense of because I could just sense this theater full of people who
didn't
were
like
just
it.
Actively hating it. And
you were at the Ziegfeld opening night, weren't you?
No, I was at Sony opening night, Sony on 68th, yeah. and everyone was just like left baffled, like and some were just laughing. And
so how can that not affect your own?
Isn't that interesting though? Like, you know, when you talk about objective responses, I mean, I'll admit my reaction was not objective. It was very much sort of like the person in the, you know, the lone person with a conscience almost. You know, it's like this film is not that bad. And then, you know, in some
watching
ways
films by yourself is always better. I hate to say it, and all these older critics
maybe, but the same
that.
I don't know, I don't think it's better or worse. I mean I think it leaves you to your own.
I think comedies are definitely better with a crowd.
With a crowd, sure.
Even if, I mean, it's just more fun
as long as everyone's in tune. Well, yeah, yeah. I really do think it has.
See, that's
to be
what's cheap about the theater to me.
Yeah.
No. I'm talking about plays. It's an audience experience.
Well,
and if everybody's laughing, suddenly something that's a piece of shit can seem like it's a birthday cake. You know, then you go away and it's like, oh.
Knocked Up was like that for me because I enjoyed the hell out of myself when I saw that in the theater.
Same here. Then maybe
a month later I wasn't so sure, and now it's like, you know, when I saw Happy Go Lucky, I was like, yeah, this, you know, if the world was a fair place, Mike Lee would be making as much money as Judd Apatow is, because this movie is like so much better than like Knocked Up.
I had to rewatch Knocked Up that last summer for a class.
Why did his movie go on forever? On forever.
Yeah,
he doesn't know anything. It's like this
Herzog
comedy. It goes on and on.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is I have a bias towards wanting to like comedies. I feel like comedies don't get a fair shake in terms of being regarded as like great works.
Yeah.
And you know, I definitely want to see if I can find a place in my top 10 of the decade for a comedy. So, you know, I'm going to look at Anchorman and Talladega Nights and
Kung Fu Hustle.
I enjoyed Anchorman.
I feel, but what you say is true, Dan. I mean, comedy is, I think, is even more subjective than,
subject to the vicissitudes of circumstance. If it's funny and it works, if you're watching it by yourself, you'll laugh. I laugh at things.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
No, Rylan can probably going crazy at the Looney Tunes movie.
Well, you're a big, I'm not a big laugher.
So to get Dan to laugh is very...
I was watching this pretty lousy Frank Cashlin movie called Caprice before we started.
Yeah.
And it's really not fun. Like, none of it is funny. It's interesting. But then there's one section where Doris Day is trying to get a snip of somebody's hair. And Michael J. Pollard is a dirty hippie who keeps putting his hand on her knees. And she keeps popping her eyes. And then I laughed. And it was funny.
Yeah, I mean, comedy is something I really like to think more about because it doesn't make much sense, you know? It's very
personal taste.
Yeah.
Something that makes someone laugh won't make somebody else laugh.
Oh, this Dan at Burn After Reading. No, when the dildo chair and Francis McDormand's reaction.
I
was downstairs because I didn't want to.
You
watch
never hear me laugh.
Again.
I'm always hearing.
And all
laugh.
Of a sudden, like at the, I, you know, all of a sudden, I hear this ha ha from upstairs, and I was like, "What? He never laughs." And then I talked to him afterwards because I knew he was watching Burn After Reading, and I was like, "Was it the dildo chair?" And he was like, "It wasn't really the dildo chair. It was Frances McDormand's reaction to the dildo chair
that she liked it.
Yeah, that she liked it.
That's what made me laugh.
Yeah. Yeah, those guys know how to continue and make
no. Because the thing is that I haven't really liked their comedies very much, and like they kind of made my skin crawl.
Yeah,
but this one I think is just, and like I watched it a second time at home with my parents, and they liked it, and I still liked it, and I just think it's kind of perfect.
Yeah, I think it's really good.
And so, maybe even like a classic comedy.
Wow, that's nice. Yeah.
It's like a well-oiled machine, not in a bad way.
Yeah.
And everybody is working just at a top level for them in their very different ways. And Frances McDormand is triumphant.
Yeah, I mean,
triumphantly vulgar.
Yeah, it's not. It's a nasty thing. It's not, you know,
but not too nasty. Like, not off-puttingly.
I don't think so. I think my father and his lady definitely think so. I think it's definitely a common reaction to be totally turned off by all that, because it is, I don't know, I understand the reaction that sees it as...
I think what it is they're idiots, and and that's fine. I think what would be offensive or irritating is if I felt that they as directors which some directors do, wanted us to feel something else, or wanted it, like not be sort of amused by it, like wanted us to feel, you know, kind of something more complicated. If it was more complicated, if they were trying to make it more complicated, it might not work. But I think their tone is pretty much spot on, and the actors all do what, you know. I think it's an actor's movie, and it's the screenplay, you know.
Oh, yeah, they are smart guys.
It's just all very casual and very, you know, it's got that casual kind of mastery of like a late Howard Hawks or something, where everybody's just improvising. And, well, why don't you do this, and then we'll do that. And, you know, they're not taking it too seriously, and it just all works.
We'll have to have a Coen Brothers podcast someday, because...
Matt's a big... Did Matt's oversight like Burn After Reading?
I don't know. I don't think he's seen it yet.
I don't think he's seen it.
Oh, really?
And I'm a big defender of the run from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou through The Lady Killers, so...
Yeah. See, I can't stand The Lady Killers. Especially since the old movies. So good.
I love The Lady Killers.
Oh.
I mean, I pretty much like all their movies. I think Man Who Wasn't There is just...
That's a great movie.
That's definitely on my top 10 of the decade, probably.
I thought it was pretty to look at, but...
Yeah.
Well, we can save all that.
I think. Yeah. Well, that kind of gets to taste. I mean, if you want to get into a case study with the Coens, I'm not too excited about talking about them.
So what about Mulholland Drive? Is that going to be...
Yeah, I think I'll rewatch it. I haven't seen it since Inland Empire. I mean, I love the hell out of that film. It's, you know, it's clearly flawed in that the first hour, it's kind of like trying to find its way, and there are like these digressive segments that don't really lead anywhere, and I guess just sort of.
I know, I don't mind that.
Television. No. I mean, you could argue that it makes sense within the rubric of Lynch movie.
There are dead ends.
Yeah, but. I mean, that's taken to the nth degree with Inland Empire, I think.
That would definitely be a best of the decade. It would be like Twin Peaks, I think, but I still think Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me might be his best movie.
I'm definitely of the Inland Empire group, I think. I mean, he's a filmmaker who it's totally fucking explicit that he's making criticism of his work throughout. Like, every film is about the last
film. What about
the
Cronenberg movies?
Of the 2000s? Oh, Spider. Spider. Yes.
Spider's pretty good.
Yes.
I like the
Spider.
Newest one.
Spider is great. So you mean History of Violence?
No, I don't like that one.
I might rewatch History of Violence.
Eastern Promises is pretty good.
Eastern Promises is good, but I mean, it's not.
Interesting, but I think he hit the 80s. I think all those great movies.
Yeah, I think he's lost.
These are all interesting, but.
I mean, I have no desire to revisit Lost in Translation. I think my opinion of that is pretty concrete.
I feel like
that was a movie that was of the moment. And
yes, I really liked it in the theater,
now,
and then I watched it recently, and it didn't hold up at all.
Yeah.
I think
at
I overrated
it. Feels,
it.
It feels paper thin to me.
I think I overrated
it. Everybody did. Practically everybody did.
You know, and actually, a film I'd hate to admit, I need to rewatch it because it was picked, you know, best of the year by the IndieWire poll, was Flight of the Red Balloon, which I thought was a great film. You know, I wrote about it very enthusiastically for The House.
Yeah, you did.
But I had no expectation that would rate so highly among my peers, and to the point I'm actively like dubious of it, just because, I mean, here's a director who I think his best work was in the 80s and 90s, and then since he's left
Puppet
his
Master.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's part of the thing. It's like, you know, the reasons I like Ho Chun, I think he's one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, is could very well be different from what, you know, whoever voted best of the year. And that really kind of irks me. Like, and I don't want to say, like, you know, well, I get it because I'm, you know, of a certain culture,
now,
so I get his, like,
but
his
now this is
films.
But now this is getting into the reaction to something, and reading the reaction to something based on a poll.
See,
and
like, Flight of the Red Balloon underwhelmed me, and then, like, it happens all the time with me. I read It's the Best Film of the Year on every single blog, and then suddenly in my mind, like, not in this particular case, because I think, hopefully I'm past this, but I think in the past, I've kind of been like, I didn't like it at all when I watched it, but then I read enough positive things about it, and suddenly it was good. You know, in my mind,
right? You get brainwashed.
You get brainwashed. Yeah. Barely help it.
You thought that Juliette Binoche was really good, and then you came out of it. Pretty...
It's her best performance of her career, I think.
She's spectacular, but just as a film, I didn't really
But I, you know, and I kind of wonder if it's actually, like, because it's in Paris, because it has this sort of film history behind it, and because it has Juliette Binoche.
Everything you do with her is great, and the set piece where she's fighting, like, towards the end, that's really good. But everything with the kid and the balloon and the man, and the girl who's taking care of him, ugh.
I kind of agree with you. I mean, it was it didn't bother me, but it was all sort of there. I mean, it's a very easy film to kind of sit back and enjoy. And I read reviews saying, like, oh, it's better and cheaper than Therapy. And I was like, also, well, if that's the reason you go to a movie, then
the fact that Juliette Binoche created her role from scratch.
That's amazing.
From scratch.
Right.
It really is. I think that the achievement of the movie, so much of it goes to her.
But best of the year, I don't think it's like one of the five best films of his career. And there are a lot of people disagree with me, and that gets the whole issue of, you know, what sort of values are informing what we think about this director. We may agree that he's one of the greatest directors, but on what grounds?
Somebody saying that Topaz is one of the great movies of 1969 or something, or the greatest of 1969 because Hitchcock made it. Fly of the Red Balloon is a better
movie. And
isn't
there anything out there? There are these directors that people will take these counter positions on, like, you know, oh, so-and-so film that's, you know, Magnificent Emerson is better than Citizen Kane, or, you know, Touch of Evil is better than Citizen Kane.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
I mean, there's a lot of that going
on. That's so idiotic. They're all great.
Yeah, right. But, you know what I mean? Like,
well, but I'd say that our reactions to the things we love tends to fluctuate. You know, with time,
Is Vertigo better than North by Northwest?
I'm not even going to get into
that. Is Rear Window better than The Birds?
They're very different films.
They're all great. Yeah.
But it gets into this sort of possessorship of, you know, now, my Hitchcock versus your Hitchcock.
Is Vertigo better than Mr. and Mrs. Smith? Sure. But, you know, like, it's I don't know.
Yeah, right, but that's...
We
but
can
that's,
bring this back to Manny Farber, I think, and his saying that in that interview at the end of Negative Space, he says criticism itself has nothing to do with hierarchies, which leaves it open for him in his personal life with Kent Jones to talk about whether
or not... To do it for his own pleasure.
Yeah, whether or not he likes Marnie more than Vertigo, you know? I don't know if that's true.
What a problem Marnie is.
Yeah, Marnie is... the first half is fucking phenomenal, and then the second half gets kind of zeitgeisty and weird.
Well, no, it's one of those movies that changes every time you watch it.
Yeah, that might...
It's great suddenly, and then you go, wait a minute, this is terrible. This is like some awful old 40s Freudian melodrama. It's awful. And then, I don't know.
But it's still one of my favorites, just because it is so messy.
Tippy, baby. It's all about Tippy.
Tippy is my favorite. But what I'm saying is that, I think we get trapped in this hierarchy thing a lot, and it's just because...
Which is maybe why, ultimately, I wouldn't want to do a 10 Best of the Decade.
Right. And that's why I don't want to rank them.
But I would like to read some other people's, just to see what...
It's such a hook. I mean, that's why I do my 1,000, that's why I'm probably doing this, like, decade in review thing. It's a hook. That's right. Why people would...
And it might stimulate some kind of reaction, hopefully.
I mean, if you can come up with this compelling a hook... I mean, Jim Emerson had an interesting hook, because he turned his top 10 into a video essay. That's the new media hook.
I think the thing is that since there are so many, they all tend to look the same. You come up with one that has something different, which isn't outrageous, which doesn't put, you know, bad movies or maybe throw on one that's a little...
I wonder if that motivated my interest in putting Speed Racer on my list.
Because Flight of the Red Balloon is such a safe choice.
Yeah.
I think that's why. It's such a safe choice.
It was also just kind of a...
Nobody's going to be negative about it, aside from Armin White or whoever.
Armin was very negative, yes.
But that's just, you know. So, yeah.
Hipster ho.
It's a little too...
Yeah. It's almost like the number one film of every year is almost like the film that you want to move away from, because it's like...
Yeah, a couple of years ago it was The Death of Mr. Lazarscrew, right?
Grueling movie.
I love that movie. That's a film
I would never, ever want to watch.
I'll revisit it.
Yeah, you know what?
I watched 30 minutes of it, and I was like, I don't want this in my body.
Well, that's the thing. It's like the first 30 minutes is the toughest, because you're just with this guy that's like...
But you know what? There's a really great...
And then it moves into this amazing...
There's a really great Romanian film coming out at IFC Center this year that I saw at Sarasota last year called California Dreamin'. And that was made by a 29-year-old director who died before it was entirely completed editing. So in parentheses next to the title, it's it's translated as endless, which of course everybody makes fun of, but you know,
how long is it?
It's 154 minutes, but I mean, it's what they basically mean is film without end, because it was never brought to completion by him, even though the film as it is
he died
in a car accident. Right. Yeah. But that's a movie that I think touches on some of the issues of Lazarescu without being so relentlessly dour and such. It's a film that's very full of life. Mm-hmm. And I think if I were to talk about value and criteria, I'd
say... You brought
say,
this up before. Oh, a synecdoche.
Well, and we can bring that up.
Yeah.
I feel like that there are movies that can have the most depressing subject matter ever. I mean, Mouchette is no Walk in the Park or whatever, but you know...
But it's got this spark to it.
But it's elating. The word I use is elation. Because you get to the end of something, and even if you have been put through the fucking ringer with it, like the New World, the last scene in the New World where Pocahontas dies, I cry every time. It is Pavlovian. I cannot stop it. I tried to control it this most recent time I watched it. It just did not work. It is impossible for me to watch that last scene and not cry. And yet, I am willing to go through that every time.
Yeah, Million Dollar Baby does that for me. Because I was editing some footage from that film for the Eastwood video podcast. But part of it, you know, I have to admit, part of it is because I think it's just an amazing film. And I know that there are people who disagree with me about that. But that's not going to stop me. Mm-hmm. And there are some like personal associations with it, because you know it reminds me of certain family experiences that I've had.
Mm-hmm. See, there you go.
I mean, but you know, there's no getting around that. But you know, and people use that to discredit me with some films. Like some Ho Chao Shen films, people think it's just so because I'm you know of Taiwanese descent that I'll defend these films. But that's a very unfair way to discredit a person's point of view, because I think we all have that.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter
As long as the way you write about them is a way that is that kind of takes off from that.
Exactly. Into a space that people can really kind of
moving from the singular to the universal.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's what we all do. That's what artists do.
And you move back to the singular too. It's always about that movement between the two that might help somebody enjoy your experience and appreciate that. And that's something that's really hard. That's why it can spawn a 2-hour talk or however long this thing is so far.
We are. we do seem to.
Which I think, you know, we might want to cut off. Because I think people might get tired. They probably are tired. I'm kind of tired. So
yeah.
If you guys got through this, I think there's some good stuff in here. Maybe in pieces you got through it. So, I don't know. Thanks for listening. Maybe that helped.
Thanks for having us, Ryan.
Yeah,
thank you.